On Tech News Today, Samsung gets slammed in the stock market after reporting another drop in profits. Canada slams China for hacking, and China slams back. Europe is getting ready to slam Google for abusing its mobile operating system monopoly. And FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler slams Verizon for throttling unlimited data customers. All that slamming and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, July 31st, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. Jason Howell is off today. Anthony Nielsen is filling in. Thank you for filling in, Anthony. And Elise Hugh is with us today because it is Thursday. How you doing, Elise?
I'm doing great, Mike. Great to be here.
Now, you wrote a really cool piece about the sort of the everybody leaving Foursquare, unhappy with the fact that they got rid of check-ins and maybe other changes. That was really interesting. Now, you discovered a Twitter account called Kill Swarm App. What is this?
Yes.
What is that account? What is that?
You can find it at twitter.com/killswarmapp, and it basically retweets all the folks who are declaring that they're quitting Foursquare because of Swarm. So Foursquare last week spun off its check-ins to a totally different app that doesn't really interface very well with the original, and took away sort of all the core features of Foursquare that people, the hardcore users, really loved. Not just check-ins, but also badges, earning mayorships. And people are not happy about it. The ratings for the app, in the Swarm app in both the Google and the iTunes store are down to 2 or 1.5 out of 5. There's all of these social media movements to try and get rid of it. This isn't as bad as the rollout of New Coke or the Netflix Quickster situation, since that affected more users, more consumers. But the folks who used Foursquare and aren't using it anymore are pretty upset.
And I would categorize this under our continuing series about companies that take their most loyal and passionate users for granted as they have envy of what their competitors have and try to recreate themselves in the image of their competitors, in this case, Yelp, I would guess. Well, Elise, why don't we jump into it and see what happens? What do you think?
That sounds great. I'm ready.
All right. Well, Samsung posted a 25% drop in second quarter profits, a third straight quarter of profit declines for the company. Samsung also said the rest of the year would, quote, remain a challenge, unquote. Dan Seifert is a reviews editor for The Verge, and Shara Tipkin is a senior writer for CNET, and both of them join us now. Welcome to both of you.
How you doing?
Hi.
Glad you're here. Hi. Now, we'll start with you, Dan. Samsung's press release said that, quote, prospects for growth remain unclear as competition over global market share intensifies in the mobile industry, unquote. They're basically saying Chinese handset makers are eating their lunch, aren't they?
Yeah, pretty much. You know, if you look at what's happened so far is that these Chinese handset makers that are able to make handsets very low cost and get them out into the Chinese market, they're just eating them up in China, and it's eating up Samsung's entire low end. Generally, when we think of Samsung here in the U.S. or in Western markets, we think of like the Galaxy S5 and its higher end products. And the S5 is actually selling pretty well. Samsung says it's 10% better than last year's model S4 at this time. But we're finding out that Samsung makes the bulk of its profits on the low end, and that's where it's getting beat by the likes of Huawei and companies like Xiaomi and things like that.
So if they're abandoning the low end, Dan, and turning their focus, it says that they're shifting to new premium mobile devices with, quote, new materials. What does that mean?
That's a good question. What does that mean? You know, for a long time, people have complained about Samsung's materials. The phones are tending to be much more plasticky than competitors like Apple or HTC. They don't feel as nice in your hand, and they don't look as nice. So for a long time, people have wanted Samsung to do something with better materials, whether that be metal or other more interesting composites. And it seems like, you know, the company is saying that we're going to do that. We're not telling you what exactly we're going to do, but hopefully in the near future we'll see a good Samsung phone that's not made out of glossy or yucky plastic.
Now, of course, Shira Tipkin, one of the things that companies do when they have earnings reports is they kind of reassure their shareholders that they're working on it, they have a plan. And, you know, in the case of Samsung, their number one priority is the high end. Their other number one priority is the low end. Their third number one priority is the mid-range. And their fourth number one priority is the wearables market, which they actually said that they would be coming out with a more diverse product portfolio in wearables, which is amazing because they have, what, four watches already.
Yeah.
They've also had there have been some hints that they're working on smart glasses type thing. I mean, is you know, a more diverse portfolio in wearables going to help them financially? I mean, it doesn't seem like a very lucrative market anytime in the near future. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that most people agree that wearables is potentially a big market, but not a ton of money in it, at least not right now. And I think the problem for Samsung is they always have diverse portfolios, but it's just sometimes there's too many options. Like with their current products, it's do you go with the Gear 2 Neo or the Gear 2 or the Galaxy Live, or I guess the Gear Live, the version that runs Android Wear. So I think it's pretty confusing for consumers. You know, I think if they're going to do something that makes this more diverse, it needs to be something that really, you know, could maybe apply to a certain niche of consumer, you know, kind of how the Gear Fit is aimed at, you know, more fitness buffs.
Sure. It's interesting that this news came out just as earlier this week. I was looking at a bar graph showing Samsung's dominance in Asia. And so is this kind of a loss of market share just inevitable because they were sort of early in certain areas of the market?
I think the issue is Samsung doesn't want to play at the really cheap devices. I mean, you know, no one does. You don't make any money there. You can have a lot of volume, but if you're not making anything from the devices, it doesn't make a lot of sense to play there. You know, that's what we've also seen Apple. And, you know, Samsung will definitely offer lower prices than Apple in these regions, but it's hard for them to compete against local, regional, you know, handset makers like Lenovo, like Huawei. These guys who are posting, you know, 95% market share growth in a quarter, you know, which is just incredible. You know, they're just growing very quickly. So it's going to be a big challenge for Samsung, but also a vital challenge, you know, if they want to hold on to their position.
Dan Seifert, you know, maybe I just have a sunny, optimistic personality, but Samsung's profit, yeah, they declined. And there's a lot of doom and gloom in the press around this, but they made $4.31 billion in the quarter in profits in a handset market where only two companies are making any profits at all that are worth writing home about. You know, there are dozens or maybe even hundreds of handset makers that are breaking even or losing money, and here they're making multiple billion dollars in a single quarter. That's not bad. And also, their loss of market share, isn't that just an inevitable result of the fact that, you know, their old market share numbers were based on the fact that they were really early. They got into the smartphone market early, and they, you know, now have all kinds of imitators and follow-on companies. There's no way they could have maintained their old market share, really, could they? I mean, they're doing pretty well, aren't they?
You know, I think that's exactly right. That puts it kind of into perspective. You know, as you mentioned, they made over $4 billion just from their mobile division, which is a lot of money, especially in mobile phones where, as you mentioned, only two companies are really making a lot of money. But the problem that Samsung has is it's, and especially for its shareholders, is that it's less money than it used to make. And for shareholders and for Wall Street, that's all they care about. But the reality is Samsung's still very much a leader in this market. It's going to be that way for a good amount of time for the foreseeable future. But if it wants to be able to continue its growth and keep its profits up, it's going to have to change its approach on some things. You mentioned that, you know, they were the first ones in this market and they have this huge market share. I think, you know, a good parallel to that is what happened with Apple and the iPad. The iPad was the first consumer tablet that people really wanted to buy, and Apple owned the tablet market for a really long time. But as other companies caught up, they started chipping away at Apple's iPad market share. And now the iPad doesn't have nearly as much market share as it did a couple of years ago. And we're seeing the same thing happen with Samsung in Asia. So it is a bit of an inevitability. Nobody's going to have a monopoly in a market like this. There's just far too many players, and it moves too fast for that to happen.
Very quickly, one final question, Cher Tipkin. You know, Samsung said that it overestimated smartphone demand. That's a big risk for companies, and it's a very difficult market to estimate demand. But is that a risk for Apple, too, for the iPhone 6? There have been some reports that they are preparing unprecedentedly large numbers of iPhone 6 devices for the market. They could find themselves in the same boat as Samsung, couldn't they?
Yeah, it's definitely possible. But I think for Apple, you know, what's expected with the iPhone 6 is a bigger screen, which is something that a lot of people have been waiting for. And it's also a reason why Samsung has been doing particularly well. You know, its larger screen devices are very popular. So, you know, we'll just have to see. I think, you know, Apple, every time an iPhone launches, you know, you have to wait a month to get it. There's always shortages. So maybe they're just trying to plan a little better. So, you know, maybe you won't have to stand in line for, you know, 2 days to get the phone.
I think you're probably right, in part because Samsung was earlier than Apple in succeeding in the Chinese market. Apple, there's some pent-up demand in China for the iPhone. So Apple will probably have a pretty good release. Dan Seifert is at TheVerge.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at DCSEIFERT. Thank you so much for joining us, Dan Seifert.
Thank you for having me.
And Shara Tipkin is at CNET.com, and you can follow her at Shara Tipkin on Twitter. I'm going to spell that. That's S-H-A-R-A-T-I-B-K-E-N. Thanks for joining us on Tech News Today.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, in a sec, we're going to find out why Canada isn't so thrilled with China. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is a free site that will help you get your money together. The first way that they'll do it is literally bring your money together. Your money is scattered all over the internet in different accounts with different passwords, and it will bring all of those accounts and all that information, all that data, basically how much money and what the balances are on all these different accounts, into one simple, easy to understand, intuitive graph and charts with data's numbers right there in front of you, a single screen that you can look at on your phone, with your tablet, your computer, on any device. And that is super nice because you can really get an intuitive sense of what's happening with your money. If you have an Android Wear watch, like I do, you can use the Android app on your phone, and that will automatically support the Android Wear watch. It'll detect the watch and put financial alerts on your wrist, which is really, really nice. Personal Capital was one of the very first companies to support Android Wear. And it's a really cool app for both the phone and the watch. Personal Capital will also help you save money on fees for managing your money. They'll tell you and show you exactly how much you're overpaying in fees and show you how to reduce those fees. You also get tailored advice on optimizing your investment. So there's no need to wait. Signing up takes just a minute, and it pays big dividends. To get your free account, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And remember that Personal Capital is free, and it's a smart way to grow your money. And we thanks Personal Capital for their support of Tech News Today. Well, Elise Hugh, why isn't Canada happy with China?
Well, China is apparently, according to the Canadians, hacking into the main computer network of Canada's leading research body. Now, China says, and its foreign ministry, the Chinese foreign ministry, is shooting back, saying this is an irresponsible accusation, but this isn't the first time that China has been accused by other governments of hacking into national security resources, as you know, Mike. So joining us to talk about this is the reporter who's covering it, Stephen Chase from the Globe and Mail in Toronto. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Well, thank you for joining us and kind of set the scene for us. Based on this hacking situation and the ones in the U.S., what are the Chinese going after?
Well, in this case, the National Research Council is this body which works with people who've discovered things that have got, you know, patented intellectual property, and they try to find ways to commercialize it. So presumably inside the NRC's computers are, you know, are access to corporate secrets, to sort of patented, data and so on. And it appears that's why hackers would want to break into the National Research Council. I'm not familiar with the U.S. situation, but that's the case with the latest incident in Canada.
Well, Stephen Chase, the playbook for China appears to be that they take this very broad approach to hacking everything in sight. They've been, you know, we've been reporting on them hacking Israel's Iron Dome technology. They've, of course, hacked the United States and Europe and all over the world, pretty much anywhere they can get in to steal whatever they can. And and then when they're confronted, and oftentimes they're not confronted because the repercussions can be kind of severe economically, they always hit back. And the first thing that they do is do what they have done with Canada, that is to say that it's an irresponsible accusation, et cetera, et cetera. And then the second thing they do is that they start investigating the companies that are based in that country. So we might expect that BlackBerry, for example, might start having trouble in China. Is that a concern within Canada?
It is. People really don't know. This is the first time the Canadian government has acknowledged this. In the past, reporters, journalists have learned who hacked, but the government never came out publicly and said that. This is the first time the Canadian government, on the record, has named and shamed China. And so I think there's some apprehension about how it's going to all play out.
That's what I was going to ask you, Stephen Chase. When will these escalating claims of cyber espionage actually have economic results? What are you hearing?
We're not hearing anything at the moment. People are still trying to get a handle on the fallout. The Canadian government was planning, the Prime Minister was planning a big trip to China this fall. And so there was, it was supposed to be the Canadian government actually had frosty relations with China. Going back a couple of years, and they've done a few things. They've taken a few measures unrelated to technology. They actually blocked Chinese state-owned oil companies from buying any more of the oil sands. So it's been sort of an off-and-on relationship, and we've kind of suffered in various ways in the past in terms of our banks and financial institutions and our insurance companies being able to make inroads into the Chinese market, which is very complicated for foreign financial institutions. So that's largely been the experience that Canada's had in terms of frustrations with China. We haven't heard, and of course this may come in the weeks and months ahead, we haven't heard of Canadian tech companies getting targeted.
Now, in the United States, of course, there's been an ongoing controversy, I guess, with Chinese industrial espionage, which takes the form of Chinese nationals within Silicon Valley and elsewhere being arrested for stealing secrets and so on, being accused of those things. In most cases, many of those court cases are still pending. There have been multiple hacks on multiple levels, and there's a certain amount of fatigue among the public that I'm detecting within the United States, where it's like, okay, yeah, of course, yeah, China hacks everything, and it's, we've kind of gotten over it to a certain extent. There's not a lot of outrage around it, especially in the wake of the NSA revelations by Edward Snowden, that many of the things that the United States government was accusing China of doing, the U.S. government, in fact, was doing to those very same Chinese companies. For example, there were certain companies that were banned, Huawei and so on, within the U.S., and it turns out that the U.S. was actually hacking Huawei devices and so on. And so the outrage factor is not very high these days. How is it in Canada? What's the public reaction to this news?
That's a good question. Everybody's on summer vacation right now, so it's...
sounds pretty stressed out about it.
Yeah, exactly. People read the news. People are aware of the sort of growing problem of Chinese hacking around the world. We just had a case, I think it was last 2 weeks ago, where a Chinese fellow accused of being behind a corporate espionage conspiracy to steal fighter jet secrets is actually a Canadian immigrant who is now being stripped of his residency status and sent home. So the story's been in the news for a while. Canada's top spy agency said a few years ago that China's the number one espionage threat. So there's a lot of familiarization with this. What's different this time is that the Canadian government is taking them on directly, from the Prime Minister on down. And that's changed and added an element of politics to the situation that we didn't have before. I don't know in your case if you had how often you had Mr. Obama, for instance, in the U.S. making those same kind of statements, but it's becoming now wrapped up in the up and down Canada-China relationship, which has been a source of a lot of stories over the last few years.
It certainly has. Well, Stephen Chase writes for theglobeandmail.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Stephen Chase. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Well, European regulators are getting ready to take action against Google for abusing Android's 80% market share, according to a report by Reuters. The action will come after a nearly four-year investigation. Alexei Oreskovic And Fu Yun Chi wrote the story for Reuters, and Alexei joins us now. Welcome, Alexei.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And we're glad you're here. Now, what abuse are the Europeans going to accuse Google of actually doing?
Well, right now, they're really just trying to kind of, it's more of a fact-finding process. So they're sending out questionnaires to all sorts of all the handset makers and telecom operators that work with Google that use Android, and they're really trying to find out what the policies are to use to license Android, and whether there's any kind of requirements that would preclude handset makers, for instance, from offering other services other than Google services on it, or whether the contract maybe gives Google an unfair advantage within Android to impede other rivals in the mobile space.
Now, Google has said that in a statement that it's committed to keeping Android open and that anyone can use Android without Google. Do we take Google at its word here that they are being open?
Well, I mean, when they say Android is open, it is true that there, you know, Android is an open source software. So there is an open source version of Android that anybody can use and do anything with that they want with it. For that, you know, I mean, you've seen forked versions of Android. You've seen versions of Android on, you know, that anybody could just take and create their own device with. But then there's also the Android that are the more recent, you know, the versions of Android that are the most recent versions of it that companies use. And for that, it requires a license. And there's different licenses involved. It's unclear exactly how they all operate because a lot of that stuff isn't public. And I think that's exactly kind of what the EC is trying to look into right now and to get a better understanding of whether any of these contracts are in fact, anti-competitive.
It's pretty muddy water there, isn't it? It's not like Windows back in the 90s when Microsoft was being accused of being a monopoly. Clearly, that 80% figure is a combination of the licensed, Google version of Android plus the open versions, which Google doesn't control. And like you say, they're trying to find out exactly if there is control and exactly what the relationship is there, but it's not as straightforward as it sounds. Now, they've been sending questionnaires to various companies to find out what these requirements are that Google puts on companies that use Android, and you've seen one of them. What are the questions that they're asking these companies?
So they're pretty detailed. This is something that they've been kind of looking into for a couple of years now, and they've sent out some questionnaires in the past, but they haven't been nearly as detailed as they are now. The most recent one has 40 questions, asking for documents going back to 2007, which is when Google first introduced Android, so going back all the way to the beginning, and asking questions about everything from any kind of revenue share agreements that companies have with Google to any requirements to not use other competing services, to whatever their own experiences and difficulties have been in using app stores other than the official Google Android app store. So they're really trying to look into, you know, the various ways that that Android, the terms of using Android, both for the Android operating system itself, as well as for kind of additional services like, you know, an app store, for instance.
Alexei, if the European regulators do find wrongdoing, what would be the penalties for Google that they would face?
Well, the EC does have the power to fine companies up to 10% of their annual revenue. So in the case of Google, I mean, we're talking, that equates to billions of dollars a year, potentially. They've been looking at the search thing now for 4 years, and post-settlement and that already has no, you know, wouldn't include a fine. So, you know, whether it actually, you know, the Android thing would actually get to the point where the European Commission felt they had a strong enough case to potentially fine them versus just, you know, working out some kind of a settlement is still really to be seen. And that's going to depend a lot on the new EC commissioner who's going to take over in November, replacing the current one.
It seems like no matter what, Europe is always unhappy with Google about something. If it's not their street view cars taking pictures of German homes, its search engine results and whether or not they're being fair to their competitors. And now they've got a beef with Android. So what a relationship they have with Google. We'll see how it goes. Alexei Oreskovic is at Reuters.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at LEXNFX. Thank you so much for joining us, Alexei.
Thank you.
Well, in just a sec, we're going to find out what Tom Wheeler is saying to Verizon, but we just got a breaking news story that CIA Director John Brennan just apologized to a Senate Intelligence Committee for and admitted that the CIA hacked a Senate computer network.
Senator Feinstein.
That's right, and spied on them, which is interesting in the case of Feinstein because she has been a big supporter of the NSA and the CIA, and then found out that, in fact, the Senate was being hacked by these organizations. So pretty interesting. And he just apologized and admitted it. So that is breaking news. I don't think anybody is going to be all that surprised. So why is Tom Wheeler mad at Verizon, Elise?
Well, I'm here based in Washington for a reason, Mike. I'm here with your Washington news.
That's right.
Well, Verizon has plans to throttle the service of its unlimited data customers starting in October of this year. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler is not happy about it. He has sent a letter calling the plan, quote, disturbing and, quote, deeply troubling. Joining us to talk about this is John Brodkin, senior IT reporter from Ars Technica. Hi, John.
Hey there. How's it going?
So tell us, kind of just set the stage of this situation. What's Verizon doing, and why is Wheeler so particularly disturbed about this throttling case when we know it happens with other networks?
Yeah, a few years ago, they started throttling 3G users, and it's limited to people on unlimited data plans, and it's limited to when they connect to cell towers that are congested. It's basically a way to make sure that the heaviest data users don't affect the service to other customers. What is new is they're now doing this throttling with 4G users. The reason that Wheeler objects to it isn't about the throttling by itself, because, you know, every carrier basically has to do some throttling in the most congested cell towers in order to keep the network experience good for as many people as possible. But what Verizon is doing is they have these customers who have grandfathered unlimited data, and they're on cheaper plans than newer customers. And Verizon really wants to move these customers to their newer plans, which have limited data and charges when you go over your limits. And so the policy only applies to these customers who are out of contract. And that's basically what Wheeler's objecting to, using it as punishment for unlimited data users who Verizon would, you know, want to, who Verizon wants them to pay more, basically.
As far as I can tell, this is part of the FCC's own making, because they have these rules. They're not really laws, they're just rules that they put on these companies. And they tend to use language like reasonable network management. Things, you can do certain things as long as it's based on reasonable network management. And then it's up to this vague interpretation by the companies and by the FCC about what's reasonable and what isn't reasonable. It all seems so nebulous. And this is precisely what he's concerned about. He's saying this isn't reasonable network management. Wouldn't it be better if the FCC had clearer rules for these things?
Yeah, but the reasonable network management thing itself, it doesn't even apply to wireless carriers. So the little background, they passed these net neutrality rules that prevented home broadband providers like Comcast from blocking. Actually, I shouldn't say Comcast, but from, because they have a different agreement. But anyway, the home broadband providers can't block or discriminate against certain applications, except if it's reasonable network management. But the rules against discrimination don't apply to wireless carriers. So he's bringing up this reasonable discrimination network management thing, but the rules for wireless carriers are really weak anyway. They don't even have to justify it based on reasonable network management.
So, John, if that's the case, then what could the FCC actually do about this if they are unhappy?
I think the only thing they could really do is issue a stronger set of net neutrality rules. Their current proposal also exempts wireless from... But the wireless isn't allowed to block, but they can only block services that don't compete against them, something like that. The discrimination rules don't really apply. So basically, the latest proposal, again, exempts wireless from the most strict rules that would only apply to fixed broadband providers, you know, like Comcast and Verizon Wireline, as opposed to Verizon Wireless.
Now, a cynical user might look at this sort of shenanigans where basically they're throttling users under certain conditions because of bandwidth limitations, and then they look over at South Korea and some other countries where they have super fast wireless broadband, and think, you know, this is what they're doing instead of building up the performance of U.S. networks. Is that a fair criticism? Are they coming up with these juggling systems instead of building up the performance of the networks?
I'm not sure. I don't know exactly how our networks compare to other nations. I would expect that. I think the throttling is probably pretty universal when it comes to the heaviest data users on the most congested portions of your network. I did a story earlier this week. Every carrier is doing this in some form. T-Mobile and Sprint say that they will throttle the heaviest users on the most congested cell sites. AT&T does the same thing, and AT&T actually is doing the same exact thing that the FCC is concerned about, because they're only throttling unlimited data users.
I see. Very interesting. Well, John Brodkin is at ArsTechnica.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Jade Brodkin. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Thanks.
Facebook and OkCupid have been in the news lately for treating users like lab rats and doing experiments on them. Facebook changed some users' news feeds to be more negative to see if that would change what they did on Facebook. And the OkCupid online dating site lied to some users about their compatibility with other users to see if that changed their relationships. Slate senior technology writer Will Oramus wrote a humor piece on the subject where he quoted OkCupid co-founder Christian Rutter saying, quote, "Guess what, everybody? If you use the internet, you're the subject of hundreds of experiments at any given time on every site. That's how websites work," unquote. That is an actual quote. Now, Oramus took this idea and ran away with it and suggested ways other sites might be experimenting on us, to hilarious effect, I might say. Welcome, Will Oramus.
Thanks, Mike. Glad you like the piece.
Now, first of all, before we get into some of your guesswork about what other sites might be doing, do you think the OkCupid-style experimentation is normal or common, as was alleged? Is that really how websites work?
Websites are experimenting all the time, but not probably on quite the personal level that OkCupid was doing. I mean, Slate, for instance, we've A/B tested headlines before. You know, we want to see which way of framing a story gets more people to click on it. We've A/B tested aspects of our site redesign to see, if we move this element of the page up to the top right, do people know where to find it, that kind of thing. So yeah, websites are experimenting all the time to try to improve their product, right? To try to make things better for the user. I think where the Facebook and OkCupid experiments got a little problematic for some people is that they were actually making the service worse for people on purpose, just to see what would happen.
And, I think the other big difference is that when Slate A/B tests headlines, they're not actually affecting the relationships people have with other people that they care about. I think that's a big part of why this is kind of outrageous. And I would imagine that even among social networks, this is not all that common. For example, I talked to the CEO of another site who told me on Twitter that his dating site doesn't do this sort of thing. And so I think it's actually pretty rare that the experimentation involves manipulating your mood in the case of Facebook, or your relationships in the case of OkCupid.
Yeah, it would be nice to think so. But here's the thing, is that we don't know. I mean, Facebook didn't tell people that they were running this experiment until it was published. OkCupid didn't let users know in advance that it was running experiments on them. It just, Christian Rutter comes forward now and says, oh, hey, by the way, we were running these really fun experiments on you guys, and here's what we found out. We have no idea, because the algorithms that sites like Facebook and OkCupid use are a black box. They're proprietary information. They don't have to tell us how they decide who to pair us with for dates or what to show us in our newsfeed. We just have to sort of trust that they're showing us the most relevant or useful or, you know, compatible matches for us. And so when they don't, I think it's, I mean, for some people, it's a violation of that trust. It's not like they were learning really deep insights about human nature here. I mean, maybe some of the OkCupid findings were interesting, but what they're doing is something that's behind the scenes, and they're relying on users to assume that everything is as normal when, in fact, they've changed what's going on in that black box.
So if users don't like this, Will, and there's a certain inevitability to this kind of testing, what's happening? Are they just voting with their feet essentially and leaving OkCupid and going to other dating sites, which may or may not be doing the same thing? I mean, what's happening as we become more literate about data testing?
Well, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, Facebook, look, this is, I don't think, anytime Facebook does something that angers users, people don't usually leave Facebook in droves. I mean, it's become so ubiquitous that you almost can't afford to leave Facebook. It's not like there are a lot of other options around for keeping in touch with your friends and family in that way or logging into a lot of the sites and services you use. What happens, though, when Facebook, anytime something like this occurs with Facebook and there's a public backlash, people's trust in Facebook just drops a little more. The amount that people really like Facebook or feel good about the time they spend on Facebook drops a little more. This is a huge problem for Facebook. And in fact, I think Mark Zuckerberg has been realizing the extent to which it's a problem for Facebook. It just has an increasingly bad image. People don't trust Facebook. And when Facebook is relying on you to share everything about yourself so that it can target you with ads, that trust is one of the most important things to its business. So that's a real problem. And I think they are realizing that. OkCupid, that's a different case. I mean, look, part of it was sort of lighthearted, but if I were, I'm happily married, but if I were single and signing up for a dating service today, would I maybe think about going with one of the other ones that isn't known to lie to its users about how compatible they are with potential dates? Yeah, you know, I might think about trying one of the other ones.
Now, let's talk about some of your guesses. What are some of the things Yelp could be experimenting on users with in the dark recesses of your imagination?
Yeah, so I just had a little fun with what other experiments companies might be running on you secretly without your knowledge, just for kicks. So Yelp, I said maybe they could be switching the reviews and the star ratings for the worst sushi restaurants and the best sushi restaurants. You know, maybe people will go to the bad sushi restaurants, give them a try, and some will get food poisoning, but others will love it. They'll rate it 5 stars. You know, it's the power of suggestion, like OkCupid's Christian Rutter said. Another one I suggested was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, was that Yahoo Mail could try withholding emails from users for a week or two to see if it makes them sad and lonely to not have anything in their inbox. I think those who have Yahoo Mail all know that this, in fact, happened, presumably unintentionally, last year when Yahoo Mail had a serious outage. But I said that Anheuser-Busch could switch every third six-pack of Bud Light with O'Doul's. Put O'Doul's in the can and see if people still act drunk. I mean, it worked on Freaks and Geeks episode where they put in fake beer and everybody got wasted anyway. So, in the name of science, why not give that a try?
Why not, indeed. Hilarious stuff, and everybody should go read it at slate.com. Will Ormus, thank you so much for joining us on Tech News Today.
Thanks.
You can find Will Ormus at slate.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Will Ormus. Well, TNT fan Kyle Veach posted a comment in our Tech News Today Google Plus community, and he said the following. He said, "I listen to TNT in my police car while on patrol. Unfortunately, my suspects in the backseat don't typically like it on the way to jail, but I swear I'll convert one of them someday into a fan." And we really appreciate that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we've been trying to corner the criminal market, the prison population, with TNT for a long time, and we appreciate your help with that. Kyle also started using the hashtag, #HowDoYouWatchTNT, and of course that comes on the wake of multiple others. I think we've got a couple other links in there, Anthony. People have been sending or posting on Google Plus pictures of themselves watching Tech News Today, oftentimes with food and beverages. That's a good one from George Cozy. And yeah, great stuff. So we encourage everybody to use the hashtag How Do You Watch TNT when you post pictures of yourself watching Tech News Today. Awesome.
I just love that. That's fantastic.
Isn't it? You know, and I hate the idea of people watching our show while they're handcuffed, but hey, you know.
It's another viewer.
Yeah, I'm sure that they're in the back seat going, wow, that's a great show. When I get out, I got to watch this. This is fantastic. Well, that is more or less the tech news today. Elise Hugh, thank you so much for joining us. What are you working on these days, by the way?
It's great to be here, Mike. I'm doing more future of shopping type stuff. So I just ordered a box of clothes from one of those CSAs for clothing to see how that's going to work out. And you can find me, of course, on Twitter, updating you on this process at Elise Hugh, WHO.
You heard it here first. Elise goes shopping, so you don't have to. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. See you later.
All right. Well, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, or many other options, unless you're in prison, of course. If you're free, you can exercise your freedom to subscribe to Tech News Today, and you can do that at twit.tv/TNT. Follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and please send us your thoughts and opinions. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific, tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.